Bombay, a natural harbor, and the biggest handles a quarter of the foreign trade of India. Calcutta, including Haldia, the largest terminal port of South Asia. Cochin, one of the finest natural harbors in the East. Kandla, supplement to Bombay, with a freeze trade zone created in 1965. Chennai, the man-made port. Marmagova, enjoying the second position in total traffic tonnage. Paradeep, primarily for the export of minerals, especially iron ore. Visakhapatnam, the landlocked and protected port, and the newly added Mangalore on the west and Tuticorin of the east coast. While the major ports largely handle ships on international routes and partly coastlines, there are as many as 139 intermediate and minor ports to serve the Indian coastline, which stretches over 5,560 kilometers. These ports are also helpful in foreign trade, especially in the export of such commodities as copra, coconut, coir yarn, and mattings, spices, fish, oil cake, groundnut, timber, etc. The navigational aids such as lighthouses, life buoys, fog signals, etc. too have expanded to cope with expanding shipping, transportation, and ports. Now coming to building ships and training personnel. To meet the growing needs of the shipping transportation, the government has provided the means to build ships and to train personnel for it. At present, the major ship builders building yards are the Hindustan Shipyard at Visakhapatnam, Garden Research Workshop at Calcutta, and Mazagon Dock at Bombay, with a fourth one at Cochin, all in the public sector. Several training establishments at places like Bombay, Calcutta, etc. impart education in various courses such as navigation, engineers, etc. Now coming to the problems and suggestions. While Indian shipping transportation has made large strides in the post-independence era, it is beset with many problems which need proper attention and appropriate solution. Among them, the principal ones are the following. Gross inadequacy is the first problem. The shipping facilities available for grossly inadequate for the vast country like India, considering the fact that it provides also valuable equipment for defense, the progress leaves much to be desired. This is evident from the fact that Indian vessels carry about 40% of Indian trade. No doubt it marks a considerable improvement over the past. In 1966, it carried just about 13% of trade, but it fell far short of the needs. In the world context, Indian shipping is very small indeed. It accounts to only 1% of the world fleet. Therefore, the first thing that needs to be done is to ensure a rapid expansion of shipping transport, number of ships, ports, and navigational aids. The second problem is inefficient handling. Another drawback is the inadequate facilities at ports for handling ships. Due to such difficulties as berthing delays or non-readiness of cargoes, etc., there is often congestion at ports, causing delay in loading, unloading, and moving in and out of the ports. This raises costs, resulting in high freight rates. The inadequacy of ports will further be acutely felt with the large increase in the traffic in the years to come. The remedy obviously lies in raising the efficiency of ship handling at ports by utilizing the existing facilities in a more scientific way. The next problem and suggestion is raising labor efficiency. In improving the efficiency of shipping transport, there is the need also for the better utilization of dock labor. The necessary prerequisites for this are proper organization of labor, proper supervision, satisfactory condition of work, and harmonious industrial relations, etc. Since in this field, technological improvements in the most advanced countries have to be adopted to stay in the world competition, it is necessary that labor is taken into confidence in respect of such changes to avoid work stoppages. This will ensure increased mechanization of the vessel turnaround time and a rapid clearing of cargo more rapidly from docks, with the latest possible reduction in labor force. The next is improving administrative efficiency. The need for improving administration of shipping transport, in particular at the port level, is urgent for the following principal reasons. Shortfall in the development projects are in no small measure due to the administrative delays and the time-consuming procedures. Lack of a proper arrangement has led to the preparation of master plan for different ports by the same consultants, resulting in identical plans in disregard of the different character and physical conditions, and therefore duplication of faulty planning, etc. The solution to this requires such organizational changes which not only grant autonomy to the port management but also provide an inbuilt mechanism to put right people at the right place. The next and last problem and suggestion is providing for rail and road transport. This is applicable to coastal shipping in general and is not peculiar to India. Certain practices quite often unfair of rail and road in other countries also has put coastal shipping in difficulties. As a result, trade for this section of water transport gets reduced. Freights get frozen and controlled, and expansion of coastal shipping becomes very difficult, particularly because new construction costs so much. One remedy is protection from rail and road by reserving certain goods and routes, but this has been tried at many places with not much success. Besides, this is an inefficient way of doing things. The right course is to accept the fact that coastal trade is an overflow from what the rail and road transport services cannot carry. With this frame, the next thing to do is to adopt coastal shipping to the needs of rail and road transport. For example, to accommodate the container service developed by rail and road transport, there is a need for a new type of coastal ships. Again, with the increase in the bulk carriers, ports need to be so grouped that while big ships wait at the large ports, small ships serve as feeders. In short, improvement in the shipping transport has to be a many-sided affair. By this, we completed the water transport. Now coming to the air transport. Another important part of the country's transport scenario is the airways, usually described as civil or non-defense aviation. We discuss its significance for the economy, trace its progress, and examine its problems. Important role. This mode of transport, the most modern one, is of crucial significance for the economy at present. It also holds out a great promise for the future. 1. The air transport suits best the vast and varied conditions of the country. The country we know is the big sized one. Its major industrial and commercial centers are located far apart from one another. There is a large variety of terrain ranging from high mountains to low plains, marshy lands, etc. The climate conditions too are very diverse indeed. In these conditions, the air transport is the most appropriate means of moving men and materials. The other mode of transport, namely railways, roadways or waterways, cannot be adequate, much less sufficient. These are neither possible, at least in quite many places, or can never be up to the requirement fully for all the areas, or are too expensive to provide in several areas. 2. Another very great advantage of this fast mode of transport, and the one that makes it far superior to other means of transport, is its capacity to optimize the use of very expensive and, for the country like India, the most scarce resources, such as the latest technology, the high profile managerial talent and the sophisticated administrative skills. It can bring all of them together in no time at places where they are most needed and at times when they are needed. The costs may at the face of it appear large, but the results are so large and of such great value that the costs pale into insignificance. This fast mode of transport also goes well with the present highly competitive world, where speed matters the most in respect of the timely delivery of many services at the domestic level, and more so at the global level. Further, since air transport saves time, and to an extent that cannot be matched by any other mode of transport, particularly over long distances, it places at the disposal of the country a scarce resource, namely time, for the creation of more wealth. 3. The airways are also the earners of large revenues, both in the domestic currency and foreign currencies. The users of this mode of transport belongs to the high income classes. The tourists, both domestic and foreigners, for example, prefer this expensive transport. Those coming from outside the country or those going out by and large travel by air. Add to it the increasing number of specialists like those in the field of information technology and corporate business, etc., who move about frequently within and outside the country. They contribute a lot to the passenger revenue of the airlines. Even the goods or the cargo which the airlines carry, being high valued, yield large revenues, and the cargo traffic is of no mean value, with almost a quarter of the total foreign trade in value term being carried by the airline at present. 4. The airlines are important also for the role they play in the development of the country. It contributes to the growth as a facilitative setup for the carriage of men and material. Its role in raising the growth rate of the country in recent years is of no mean order, as is evident from the large increase in its capacity and operations. The airlines will be a supportive factor in realizing the projected higher growth rate of the economy at 9% for the coming years. The air transport will also serve and promote urbanization following development, which requires a shift in distribution and concentration of population and economic activity at certain places, increase in exports that accompany growth, and free trade regime in the global economy. We'll also get a boost from the air transport. The air transport is also expected to meet the rising demand of passenger traffic associated with the expanding economy, rising population, and increasing incomes. Now coming to the significant progress. Since its beginning in 1920s, the airlines have made considerable progress. The progress slow till the end of 1930s became somewhat fast during 1940s, particularly during the Second World War. A more rapid expansion, however, took place after independence in 1947. The progress marked both the significant functional entities of the civil aviation, namely the operational entity comprised domestic and international airlines, and the infrastructural entity, airports, communications, runways, etc. A landmark in the growth profile of the civil aviation in the country is the year 1953, when air transport was nationalized. A committee 1950 recommended the integration of all private companies into four companies to avoid cutthroat competition, which was hitting hard the viability of the system, and to secure the benefits of work distribution in terms of the aid zones. The private companies, however, did not comply with the recommendation. In the circumstances, the government went in for nationalization of all the existing eight scheduled air transport companies. With this important organizational change, the government hoped to raise the operational efficiency of civil aviation, as also to provide the to avoid the wastage and losses being caused by duplication of air services at certain routes involving more than necessary flying hours, overuse of technical personnel, etc. The government constituted Indian Airlines for domestic services and for some neighboring countries, and Air India for national services. A third level airlines, Vaidut, was set up in 1981 as a subsidiary to serve the northeast region, where the surface transport facilities are inadequate and surface routes are circuitous, as also other regions later on. The Vaidut was, however, merged with Indian Airlines in 1993. Besides, provision was made since 1985 for helicopter support service to the petroleum sector, including INGC and Oil India Limited, by Pawan Hans Helicopters Limited. These services connect remote and inaccessible areas of the northeastern region of the country. It also provides aid support services to several other customers like state and union territory governments, public sector undertakings, and private sector companies. The state monopoly in the air transport lasted till 1994, when the private sector was allowed entry in this field. During the four decades of the public sector airlines, 1953 to 1994, such much progress marked the air services. There was considerable expansion of the infrastructure. There are at present 92 airports and 28 civil enclaves at the defense airports. The operation of the air services too have increased considerably. The number of passengers have gone up massively. For the 33 years from 1960 to 61 to 1993 to 94, when the progress has been especially fast, the number of passengers has increased by about 11 times, from over 9 lakh to about 99 lakh. In respect to the cargo freight, the progress is no less remarkable. In the 13 years 1980-81 to 1993-94, for which figures are available, the cargo handled at airports increased by about 2.5 times, from 178.70 thousand tons to 435.35 thousand tons. For the development of civil aviation, the government spent a lot under the plans, beginning with rupees 25 crores in the first plan, that is 1951-56, and raising to as much as rupees 7,249 crores in the 8th plan, that is 1992-97. There has been a further increase in the air services since 1994, with the monopoly of public sector airlines ended and the private sector allowed entry in this field. This has brought in the competition and, as a consequence, changes in the market share of the public sector airlines. As for the international air services are concerned, these are before continue to be provided by Air India and by Indian Airlines to some neighboring countries and foreign airlines. With an increase in the number of passenger carried and that the freight handled, in the domestic field, the Indian Airlines, though still a major service provider, lost some of its business to the private sector because of tough competition from the private airlines. The private sector airlines at present cater to as much as 46% of the domestic air traffic. The government's policy of liberalization of the economy in operation since 1991 is also envisages substantial disinvestment of the public sector airlines so as to allow the major share to the private sector. The aim is to improve the working of the government airlines and to expand their capacity. Taken together, the private and the public airlines, the growth rate has been on the rising curve, especially in the recent years. For example, the growth rate in respect to passengers handled at AAI, Airport Authority of India, airports was 6% in the period 1980-81 to 1991-92. This rose significantly to 10.2% during 1992-93 to 1999-2000. As for the cargo, the growth rate was 6.5% in the first period and much higher at 15.1% in the second period. In absolute terms, the number of passengers increased by more than 3 times, from over 107 lakh in 1980-81 to over 390 lakh in 1999-2000. As for cargo, the increase during this period has been 4 times, from about 179,000 tons to 797,000 tons. Serious problems. Despite significant progress, the airways are beset with some difficult problems. These need to be attended to urgently to enable the civil aviation to move forward on an accelerated speed. Big inadequacy. One and the foremost shortcoming of the air transport is its small size. In the world context, the Indian aviation carry an insignificant part of the total passenger traffic, both domestic and international. It is just 1.2% in 1998. In contrast, China carry more than 2.5 times at 3.2%. USA's share is massively large at 40%. Considering the stipulated growth of the economy, at 8% and rapid urbanization accompanying it in the coming years. The present capacity, unless expanded fast, can inhibit the growth itself. This can also severely limit the gain the country can derive from our policies of opening of the economy and its globalization. Even within the country, the present capacity is not able to provide sufficient connectivity to many people and isolated areas like those in the northeastern region. Besides, the backward areas have yet to be brought fully within the orbit of the modern India. The second serious problem is insufficient infrastructure. The various types of facilities for the air traffic, such as aerodromes, ground handling capacity, including navigational equipment, air communications, air traffic control systems, etc., are much short of the present, as also the future needs in the air transport. The aerodromes are small in number for a vast country like India, and those with modern facilities still very few. This has limited the reach of the domestic air traffic. In the international air traffic, where foreign companies have also been operating, India's share continues to be much less than the accepted norm of 50%. The growth of capacity has not kept pace with the rapid rising air traffic, nor has the capacity been upgraded fully. Even the available capacity has not been mentioned properly. The state of the training facilities for pilots too is far from satisfactory, nor are incentives to attract students for their expensive training adequate. The finances for this highly capital intensive system of transport have also fallen short of its requirement. The infrastructure also lags much behind the air transport of advanced countries in respect to the use of large technologies and the most modern management practices. In short, the infrastructure is not enough quantity-wise and quality-wise. The next is low efficiency. In terms of operations, the picture is no rosy with efficiency of the working of the air transport of the public sector. Far from satisfactory. Load factor, for example, when compared to other similar sized carriers, is small indeed. With capacity not being fully or largely utilized, the productivity or output level per worker and per unit of equipment is bound to be less than the potential. The fleet of the public sector aircrafts is on the whole old and aging, though the entry of private sector aircrafts have somewhat improved the situation. Yet the overall state of the system continues to be largely determined by the two big public sector companies. The inefficiency also results from less than optimum use of the aircrafts. It is so because of the time consuming handling capacity at the airports. The aircrafts also remain grounded for longer period than desirable. Since 1994, faced with competition from the private sectors, the public sector aircrafts have increasingly gone in for short distance traffic, resulting in larger fuel costs as also bigger handling costs, etc. Public sector management too is handicapped in efficiency running the system in the highly competitive world. The next is unsatisfactory regulations. The air transport, unlike other mode of transport, is subject to severe competition. Along with the public sector companies and domestic private sector companies, since 1994 there are foreign companies operating in this field. As such, there is a special need for regulating operation of these companies to ensure healthy competition. Just sharing the of market adequate air services for the remote and backward areas, right tariffs to distribute the burden of meeting social obligations, etc. Unfortunately, the regulations have not been up to the mark. As a result, some unhealthy and improper developments made the civil aviation. For example, since 1994, when the private airlines were permitted, some companies without any experience in the airline business entered the field. Some over expanded the services and made inroads into Indian Airlines market share. In the process, the capacity of the Indian Airlines to subsidize other routes like those in isolated and backward areas was reduced. Some private companies came in without adequate trained personnel and pitched skilled manpower of the Indian Airlines. Some even indulged in unhealthy business practices, such as offering more frills to the passengers, etc., thereby bringing financial ruins for some of the new entrants and affecting adversely the finances of the public sector carriers. We may now sum up. The air transport, very important for the fast growth of the Indian economy, has made some progress during the long years since independence in 1947. However, in its present state, both in terms of its capacity and operations, it is in a far from satisfactory condition. Its shortcomings need to be removed if it is to meet the needs of the country's development. Bye. With this, we complete chapter 12, Infrastructure, of the book Indian Economy. Now coming to the next chapter, that is chapter 13, National Income, Measurement, Growth and Industrial Origin. Page number 177 to 196. National income and its industrial origin mirrors the macro flows of goods and services and the economic structure of the economy. In this chapter, we examine changes in these as also in the per capita income over time. In this context, we also evaluate the relevance of the wage goods approach and the Keynesian multiplier in determining national income. However, for better understanding of the subject, we discuss first the way national income is measured in India and the difficulties one faces in this regard. Measurement and difficulties. National income is a money value of final goods and services produced in an economy over some period of time, usually a year. Final goods and services are those purchased for their own sake. They are what the economy finally wanted and obtained. We discuss in this session the subject of estimating Indians' national income. Important aggregates. Around the concept of national income, there are various concepts with different contents. Their values and are calculated in India. First is gross product. Gross domestic product, GDP, measures the total value of final output of goods and services produced within the country's domestic economy by residents and non-residents. Gross national products, GNP, is comprised of the value of GDP plus factor income occurring to residents from abroad less the income earned in the domestic economy occurring to persons abroad. In other words, GNP, that is gross national product, measures the total domestic and foreign output claimed by residents or nationals of the country. net product, net domestic product, NDP, is the GDP, that is gross domestic product minus depreciation, reduction in the value of asset through wear and tear. Net national product, NNP, is GNP, gross national product minus depreciation. All these estimates are made at market prices. The market prices are made up of costs of production, indirect taxes and subsidies. Indirect taxes add to and subsidies subtract from costs. If then we deduct indirect taxes and add subsidies to the various estimates, the resulting value will equal the cost of producing goods and services. Thus, we have two types of estimates, at market price and at factor cost. NNP, that is net national product, when calculated at factor cost, is called national income. Per capita product or income. Per capita income is another much used concept. It refers to the average income of the country. It is arrived at by dividing the national income of the country by its population. An increase in the per capita income indicates a rise in the availability of goods and services, and for this reason is often used as the index of welfare of the people. Procedures of valuation. For estimating the national product, the producing sectors are identified and the products of these sectors are evaluated at market prices. Producing sectors. The country's economy has been divided into 13 sectors, which are grouped under the following 5 heads. 1. Primary. In primary, we have agriculture, that's first. 2. Forestry and logging. 3. Fishing. And 4. Mining and quarrying. Now we have the second head, that is secondary. In that, we have manufacturing, subdivided into A, registered, and B, unregistered. The next is construction, electricity, gas and water supply. Coming to the third head, transport, communication and trade. In this we have transport, storage and communication subdivided into A, railways, B, transport by other means and storage, C, communications. Trade and hotels and restaurants. Now coming to the fourth head, finance and real estate. In this we have banking and insurance, real estate and ownership of dwelling and business services. And the last head is community and personal services, which includes public administration and defense and other services. To the value of products of these sectors is added then net income from abroad to get at the estimate of national product. Methods used for valuation of the products, both the output and the income method have been applied. The output method has been used largely in commodity producing sectors like agriculture and manufacturing. The income method has been used in the tertiary or service sector like trade, public administration, etc. This method has also been applied to some segments of commodity sectors where there is absence of output data. The third expenditure method has been used, but in a very limited way in respect of, for example, kaccha construction. In using the output method, the value added approach has been adopted. The value added is equal to the value of the goods minus the cost of production. In other words, this method measures the net contribution of the producing unit of national income. The sum total of value added by all the producing units in the commodity sector gives the value of this sector contribution to national income. The estimation is done by evaluating the value of goods at X factory prices and deducting from it the value or cost of inputs supplied by other enterprises and the estimated value of depreciation or capital consumption. In the income method, the procedure is to find out the number of people working or workforce in a profession or per head or average earnings. The two are then multiplied to get the value of income contributed by the profession. The expenditure method involves estimation of spending or disposition of income on final goods and services. Data used. In broad terms, the data required for the output method should be about production prices and cost of production. For the income method, statistics should be about the number of persons employed in different professions and their earnings. The information for estimation of is collected from various sources. These include government agencies like ministries, departments and directorates. These agencies publish data on agriculture, industries, trade, income tax, revenues, etc. more or less on a continuous basis. There are then national sample surveys, NSS, supply data on specific subjects. Reports like those of the Rural Credit Survey, Indian Rural Debit and Investment, etc. have been made use of. Censuses of population have also been made use to estimate the workforce in the absence of comprehensive employment statistics in various professions. In some cases, even outdated surveys and local inquiries are made use of for estimating certain costs. For want of data in respect of certain goods and services, arbitrary imputations are made. In regard to the use of income method, various devices have been applied for various sectors to get the data. Certain indicators have, for example, been used for different activities. In the case of industry group, medical and public health, the indicator used is the number of hospital beds. For trade, hotels and restaurants, the index of trading activity is used. In the case of non-agricultural sector, the index number of average daily wages of rural skilled labor in agriculture has been used. Serious problems. Estimates of India's national income, though much improved over the earlier estimates of the 1950s, continue to be far from satisfactory. There are several reasons for it. Conceptual difficulties. The estimates suffer from some flaws which affect even the national income estimates of the developed countries. One, for instance, is the services of housewives which are not paid for. As such, these are not included in the estimate. Second is with regards to the administrative services of the government. It is not possible to identify the services which specifically contribute to production. Third concerns the valuation of products in terms of some base year. New products which did not exist in the base year cannot be evaluated with reference to the base prices. This is particularly so in case of the country where during the development phase new goods may appear at the fast rate. Fourth, comparison between nations based on national income may also be less meaningful because of the difficulties in the purchasing power of money and the package of goods that can be purchased with the unit of money in different countries. The next serious problem is limitations of underdevelopment. There are then some difficulties associated with the underdeveloped stage of the country. For example, a significant part of the production is non-monetized. Large many transactions are conducted as barter. There is again a considerable part of production, mostly in small farms, which is retained for self-consumption. Had this non-monetized sector been small, one couple impute almost correct values to the output in this sector. But this is not so. The absence of data in the country makes the imputation all the more difficult. Hence, even nowadays, estimates of India's national income carry the stamp of guesses and arbitrary imputations.